Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering.
On behalf of Gillette Stadium, CIC Health, and the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, we thank you for playing your part in making a stand against COVID.
That is the announcement playing outside Gillette Stadium today. Gillette is a mass vaccination site, and today vaccinations opened to all Massachusetts residents age 16 and older. It is the start of our third and final vaccination phase. Here's the story with the vaccines. The Pfizer vaccine is approved for people 16 and 17 years old. Those 18 and older qualify for Moderna and Pfizer. The single-dose Johnson & Johnson vaccine remains on hold, likely through Friday, as the CDC investigates rare reports of blood clotting in women ages 18 to 48. Governor Baker estimates that an additional 1.7 million residents became eligible today, making it the largest group in the state's vaccine rollout. When the Commonwealth launched phase two of the vaccine rollout, which had smaller eligibility numbers, it did not go smoothly. So here to discuss with us what's happening this time around is WBUR's senior statehouse reporter, Steve Brown. Steve's at Gillette Stadium. Steve, good to have you.
Hi, Tiziana.
Okay, so we've been hearing stories along the way about how difficult it's been to get a vaccine appointment. Lots of calls over the month, Steve, here on Radio Boston about that. It did appear that things got a little bit better over time as more vaccination clinics opened up. There was a higher allotment of doses. Okay, so that was up to today. But now another 1.7 million people became eligible. Is it hard to get a vaccine appointment right now? Is it easy? How hard is it?
It is a bit trickier today. As you said, another 1.7 million people became eligible. That's the largest single cohort of people to date. Now, it remains to be seen if all 1.7 million will want to be vaccinated. Probably at least half do. So that's still a large number of people. Now, we had a story on WBUR this morning about vaccine hesitancy among some people, and I'm sure we'll be hearing more about that in the coming weeks as everyone 16 and above is now eligible to get vaccinated. A spokesman from CVS emailed me today to say that all of their Massachusetts stores are fully booked today, and there's been a steady flow of people going into Gillette today. The message seems to be, keep trying and be patient. A slot will open up for you, maybe just not this week.
So now, over 2 million Massachusetts residents are fully vaccinated. Nearly as many are halfway there. Is the state predicting, or what is the state predicting, how soon before everyone age 16 or older is vaccinated?
We're not entirely clear on that. It all depends on how fast the feds can ship vaccines to Massachusetts. We did hit the 2 million fully vaccinated mark on Saturday. The state hasn't put out any hard numbers of how many people will be vaccinated by when, but the governor has hinted that he'd like to see 4 million people vaccinated by Memorial Day, which is 6 weeks from today.
I remember last week the governor saying that the pause announced last week on J&J wouldn't affect supply, the ability to meet demand in the immediate term. Is that still the case? Are there enough Moderna and Pfizer doses to go around?
Yeah, there are. The states had been relying on the Johnson & Johnson vaccine to more or less turbocharge the vaccination process. You know, since it's just a single-shot vaccine, it takes half the time to get fully protected. Now, today on Morning Edition, Dr. Anthony Fauci said that he expects the FDA and CDC to determine by the end of this week when to resume distributing the J&J vaccine. But as for Pfizer and Moderna, there seems to be enough. They increased the number of doses to Massachusetts this week by 8%.
So, Steve, I'm mindful that New Hampshire also opened its doors to non-residents for vaccinations today. Does the Commonwealth have any response to that?
No, I reached out to the state to find out how things were going on this first day of everybody being eligible, and I got an automated response saying that all state offices are closed today for Patriots Day. Heading north to the Granite State does seem to be an option for people here in Massachusetts. A listener tweeted to us today saying she couldn't find any available appointments in Massachusetts last night at midnight, nor could she this morning. So she just signed up for an appointment in New Hampshire because it was easier. Of course, New Hampshire is dropping the residency requirement as of today. I think Massachusetts officials really don't care where you get your vaccine, so long as you get it.
Okay, so there are many who have been waiting for this day since December. What about tips for those who are searching for an available appointment?
Sure, you're right. People have been waiting for this for quite a while, including Ray Larkin, who just became eligible today, and he was going in to get his shot at Gillette.
I'm just happy that the state of Massachusetts is so, they have the ability to have so many people get vaccinated all this short amount of time, you know? I want to start traveling soon, so I'm really happy to get my vaccine, and yeah, definitely privileged and very thankful.
Now, Ray was in a rush to get in and get his vaccine, so he didn't share with me how he was able to secure an appointment on this first day of eligibility. There are all sorts of tricks, which our colleague Amy Gorell compiled on our website, WBUR.org. You can find them all there. A couple of familiar ones. Look for appointments in the middle of the night. That's what I did. It's kind of a bonus for having insomnia. on the pharmacy sites, if it says there is nothing available in Massachusetts, one trick is to click on another state, and when they ask for your zip code, put in your actual zip code, and you will very likely see some limited appointments. Bottom line, persistence is the key.
All right, that is Steve Brown, WBUR Senior Statehouse Reporter over at Gillette Stadium. Thanks, Steve.
Thank you, Tiziana.
So as newly eligible folks spend this Patriots Day racing to try to book vaccine appointments, Boston, for the second year in a row, will not hold its traditional April marathon. Right now, this year's marathon is scheduled for Monday, October 11th. The absence of the marathon now feels familiar. It's also a little hard to take. Last year, the first time it was canceled was the first time in its 124-year history. It shook the community and made the pandemic real in yet another new way. So this year, what does a marathon-less Monday mean for Patriots Day in Boston? WBUR's Alex Ashlock, who's covered the marathon for more than 20 years and has been talking with us about the changes to the marathon status over the last year, joins us now. Welcome back, Alex.
Thanks for having me.
So I got to believe this is a disappointing day for fans of the marathon. Have you had a chance to get out in the city today, talking to people? What's it feel like?
You know what? It actually felt really good downtown today. I went to the finish line this morning. It was a beautiful, sunny morning. And the energy downtown, in a way, was like it is on Marathon Monday. So that felt good. I kind of woke up with a disappointing feeling, but had the complete opposite when I went downtown. Part of that had to do with Des Linden. She's the 2018 winner of the women's race, and she was here to celebrate Patriots Day with a group of local runners. And she also announced that she'll be back to run the race when it happens in October. And she told me that wasn't a difficult decision.
Not at all. Not for me. I look forward to this race. It's where I got into the marathon and fell in love with the distance. So it's always top of my list. And, you know, if they keep inviting me, I'll probably keep showing up.
I think they'll probably keep inviting her. She's a big she's a big favorite here. And she ran today with five local runners. They did this Patriots Day mile event that was set up by the Boston Athletic Association to mark the holiday, even though there wasn't a marathon. And one of the lucky runners was Lindsay Devers.
It's been a year of uncertainty for sure. I'm a nurse anesthetist at Mass General Hospital, so have gone from being in the operating room to working frontline in a COVID ICU, and then and now kind of be on the tail side of things where things are starting to normalize. This kind of feels like life starting getting back to where things started.
Tiziana, after they finished that short run, the mile run, the BAA surprised Devers and the other four runners with the news that they'll be running a much longer distance in the fall. The BAA gave each of them an entry into this year's marathon, which they were not really expecting was going to happen. It was kind of an OMG moment for them.
That sounds touching, and if you're not a distance runner, mildly terrifying.
Exactly.
So. All right, so let's look ahead. What's the latest on the plan for the in-person marathon?
Well, this plan is a work in progress. There is that date, and I think you mentioned it, Monday, October 11th. Registration for all the qualified runners opens tomorrow morning. But, you know, there's still a lot of questions about what the race is actually going to look like because of the pandemic. Tom Grilk is the BAA's president and CEO. He says he and the other members of the organization have been working with this advisory panel, which is made up of health and public safety officials, on what the race might look like.
There will certainly be a need to do testing, to do all we can to make sure that we don't have people in the race or working on the race as volunteers or otherwise that might quite inadvertently make somebody else sick.
There's going to be an additional $25 charge for the entry fee this year, and that's going to help offset the cost of additional safety measures that the BAA is going to have to implement that they've never had to implement before because of COVID-19.
Yeah, I'm kind of overwhelmed by the logistics of this. Under the normal circumstances, right. It's huge. What's the plan for getting all the runners tested?
Again, it's a work in progress, and I asked Tom Grilk that question as well, and here's what he said.
For the most part, at least the way we see it now, and nothing is certain yet, but we will make every effort to make it as simple as we can, perhaps getting the tests into the hands of runners so that they can be done themselves. In some cases, they may have to appear at a location if they come in just before the race.
He also said the BAA is thinking about how vaccinations might play into all of this, and including playing into the role of testing. But as of now, there's no requirement for runners to be vaccinated in order to run the marathon.
So, Alex, I know there's essentially like a network of big city marathons.
Right.
What are the other big races doing?
Well, Boston's part of this series called the World Marathon Majors. And usually those races are spread out all across the year. But this year, they're all going to be run between the end of September and the beginning of November. That means Berlin, London, Chicago, Boston, Tokyo, and finally New York in November. The field sizes for Boston and Tokyo are going to be reduced, but as of now, London and Chicago are going to go ahead with a plan to have more than 40,000 runners. I spoke with a man named Brett Larner. He runs this website called Japan Running News, and he's been watching what's been happening in Asia.
You know, there is a lot of behind-the-scenes networking and information sharing going on between race organizers around the world. I've sat in on a few of the conference calls on those. And, you know, people that are actually going ahead with their races and you know, kind of being the front runners to test out the protocols and that are sharing that information with other races.
We are still a few months away from Boston and those five other marathons. But at some point, they're going to have to make final decisions about what those races are going to look like and, you know, what the safety precautions are going to be and how the races can be conducted safely.
So before we let you go, Alex, you know, I know you to be someone who's passionate about the marathon, about our city, about those who have served our country. And the marathon is now inextricably tied with the marathon bombing.
Right.
Last Thursday, the 15th, was the 8th anniversary. The day came and went fairly quietly with so much of our attention on the pandemic. And since we have you, I just want to ask you how you're thinking about that today.
Well, it did pass quietly, and unlike last year, though, I was glad to see that Governor Baker and Acting Mayor Janey were able to place wreaths near one of the bombing sites at the finish line, which they were not able to do last year. So we're getting farther out from 2013, but it's still an important day, and I hope that people always remember that.
That's WBUR's Alex Ashlock. Alex, thanks for joining us. It's good to talk to you.
You're welcome.
It is Patriots Day, and as we heard from WBUR's Alex Ashlock, for the second year in a row, Boston will mark Patriots Day without the Boston Marathon. In the before times, you actually might hear folks calling today Marathon Monday more than Patriots Day, at least here in Boston. So today, as we celebrate Patriots Day, now for the second time without the marathon, we thought this would actually be a good opportunity to talk about what it is we are actually celebrating. What is the history of Patriots Day, and why are we so proud of it? So we've got two guests to tell us. Stacey Frazier is the Collections and Outreach Manager for the Lexington Historical Society, and Tom Putnam is the Executive Director of the Concord Museum. Stacey, Tom, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks very much.
Great to have you both. I love history. Going to have some fun with this. Stacey, I'm going to start with you. We have heard of the midnight ride of Paul Revere, you know, one if by land, two if by sea, shot heard around the world. I want you to narrow it down for us. Take us back to the beginning. The British regulars had been in Boston for years, but on April 18th, 1775, they decided to march to Concord. Why?
Well, there's a lot of people who have done a lot better work on this than I, but I'll give you the broad strokes, the elevator speech. Essentially, we're looking at the British troops in Boston being concerned about the amount of movement from local militias and local, the provincial Congress and committees of correspondence were really kind of, they were active. And the British troops had heard of a, not heard of, they knew of a cache of munitions, some stolen cannon that had been taken by other militias from the British. And they knew that they were housed in Concord. So they basically decided to send out some patrols, send out a party, and see if they could take back the cannon and other material, war material, gunpowder and things like that. In sort of what they were hoping was kind of a secret overnight mission. They left, as we know, over in the evening. They packed about a day's rations. It wasn't intended to be a long excursion. It was intended to go, you know, hopefully be able to retake some stores and return. And as we know, that is not how it turned out.
Yeah. And not so secret, Tom, no. Right? So tell us briefly, give us again, the elevator pitch or speech of what happened next. What made this different from some of these other skirmishes?
Well, I think the lesson of those 24 hours is that the British had thought, the British Parliament, that this was some kind of rude rabble, and that General Gage was ordered to kind of, put down this growing rebellion. And instead, what they found was a very well-disciplined, combat-ready militia. So when Revere gets to Lexington around midnight, the word goes out, the militia musters. And again, as people know, at 5:30 in the morning, when the British arrive, neither side was supposed to fire, but shot breaks out. And in the end, people die there on the green. The British regulars continue their march to Concord, as Stacy indicated. That's what the goal was, to find the munitions there. And there they meet an even larger force, because, again, the word has gone out from Revere and other riders. So now in the famous battle at the North Bridge, there's actually 450 provincial troops mustering on one side of the bridge, and only 100 because the British had broken up into smaller companies. So again, the British, it was a rude surprise to them. They take many casualties in Concord, and even many more on the march back to Boston.
Okay, so a couple things here. First, listeners, oops, we're getting some feedback over the line. I think the folks in the control room will handle that for us. While they do, listeners, if you have questions about the history of Patriots Day, about what happened in that 24 hours, this is a really cool time to get to ask that question. 1-800-423-8255 is the number to call. Stacey Fraser, I'm going to turn to you. So if I understand this correctly, it really was, they just didn't think this was going to be that big a deal. If I'm not putting it too softly, and it turned out that the Minutemen, the rebels thought it was a very big deal. Is that fair to say?
I think so. Yeah, I think there was a lot more communication amongst. There were some very, very well spoken, very eager to communicate individuals in the area. You know, John Hancock, as we know, has connections both in Boston and in Lexington. Reverend Jonas Clark is the fiery minister in Lexington who has been preaching, you know, rebellion for quite a while now. There really was, and that's just Lexington, there really was a lot of support for standing up to what people at the time felt was not fair. You know, we were not being treated as full citizens. And I think that there was a lot more sentiment and a lot more organization than the troops were expecting, and certainly the commanders were expecting. And that's an interesting thing because, you know, as you said, it's not secret, and they realize that, you know, the British troops are not unaware of the fact that the countryside is alarmed. They are not going to pull off this secret thing. And you can tell there's a few moments where they're starting to, you know, say, okay, this could be something. We should maybe be concerned soon. You know, they send for reinforcements. They send a rider to Boston for reinforcements around 4 a.m., which is before fighting even starts on the green. They just know, you know, from seeing people up and about, from hearing bells and alarms in the towns they pass through, they know the jig is up and they know it's going to turn into something. So they send for reinforcements even before that, before the battle on Lexington, because, you know, this is turning into a big thing.
So I want to stop and I want to jump in there and turn to you, Tom, because I watched the visualization of these 24 hours that the Concord Museum posted online. And it really is like watching swarms come in. Mm-hmm. I mean, they are, by the time this thing is done and they are retreating back to Boston, they are just hugely outnumbered.
Yeah, it's 2-1. And I'm so pleased that you watched it. It's available online and in our museum if folks want to visit this week. The British start out with 700 troops, and as Stacy just indicated, then they call for reinforcements. So another 1,000 troops come and join them in Lexington on the return. But by the end of the day, they're outnumbered 2-1. So there's close to 3,400 local militia and Minutemen. And what's also astounding is they come from as far away as Framingham, Newton, Roxbury, Danvers, and Lynn. I mean, these aren't easy places to walk, from to get to Lexington and Concord in time. And again, the image that you're referring to is our map shows this kind of big red column of the British troops, and then all of these blue troops represented by the local militia that are coming from every town in the area. Again, it shows once again this astounding level of resistance was built on careful planning and really a decade of mounting anger against the British Parliament and the King.
All right, so we've got some calls. Let's have a little fun with this. 800-423-8255 to ask your question. We'll start with Jessica. Jessica is in the car in Boston. Jessica, go ahead.
Yes, hi. I was just curious. You guys mentioned that when Paul Revere made it to Lexington, and I don't know if I learned this wrong, but I thought I learned when I was in high school that Paul Revere got arrested and that this guy Dawes made it and that he never made it to Lexington. So I guess my question is, did Paul Revere make it to Lexington or did he get arrested? And if not, who made it to Lexington?
Okay, Stacy is Lexington Historical Society. So Stacy, I'm turning to you.
I'll take it. Yeah, so Revere is a funny guy. Revere, he basically made it to Lexington, to the home of Reverend Jonas Clark. It's now the Hancock Clark House that we interpret. It's open today and this weekend. And he got there because he knew Hancock and Adams were there. However, you are correct that along the way, he picked up some helpers, basically. William Dawes and Samuel Prescott both joined in. And you are correct that just outside of the downtown of Lexington, in a spot that's now in the National Park, he was caught by a patrol of British officers and he was held and his horse taken. So it is actually Dawes and Prescott that make it on from there and warn other towns. Revere does make it to Lexington, but he doesn't make it all the way to Concord. So the many militia groups that Tom mentions that are massing in Concord wouldn't necessarily have been there if, Revere had gotten caught just outside of Lexington and never made it all the way to Concord. My favorite part, too, of the story is that he also has to walk back when they release him. They had caught him and a few other militia scouts, basically. And when they started hearing gunfire, they released them and let them walk back. So, Paul Revere leaves Lexington on a horse bound fast for Concord with important messages. And he comes back to Boston or to Lexington around 2:30 in the morning on foot, just out of the game at that point, unfortunately.
All right. So let's get one now for Tom. We've got Karen on the line in Dedham. Karen, go ahead with your question.
Hi there. I'm calling because a local publishing company called Charles Bridge is putting out a book called Why Longfellow Lied, The Truth About Paul Revere's Midnight Ride. And I'm wondering what you two make of the fact that Longfellow really made up some history 100 years, 60 years later, that didn't really happen and made Revere a hero.
Tom.
Oh, well, you could tell that story in a more admirable way. So Longfellow was actually writing that poem right before the Civil War, and he was using it to inspire the citizens of his time to stand up for the rights and the ideals that our country stood for. But you are absolutely right. He took poetic license with the poem. So as Stacy just explained, Revere doesn't make it to Concord. In the poem, Longfellow, has him make it to Concord. So it is a piece of poetry or fiction. Today we say inspired by true events. The general note, message of the poem, I think, has integrity and can be defended.
So Stacy and Tom, we are now in a moment where our cultural institutions, our historical institutions are necessarily and rightly beginning to grapple with our racial history, our history with slavery as a city. And I know both of your museums and the towns of Lexington and Concord are now grappling with and telling stories that maybe weren't a part of the history we celebrated about Patriots Day in the past. I'd love to hear from each of you about that, maybe starting with you, Stacy.
Absolutely. We're very, very happy to be starting a new project funded by the Foundation for Metro West. We're looking at particularly slavery in Lexington at the Hancock Clark House as a starting point, because it is one of our historic properties and because it's connected with such big names in the early days of the revolution, like John Hancock, Samuel Adams, people who really talked a lot about freedom and equality and liberty. And there is an inherent tension there of these kinds of ideals being expressed and being literally fought for on the town green, but enslaved individuals in town who are either fighting in the war or just present in town, and certainly I think would have some thoughts about some of the rhetoric. And I think a big part of that is trying to look at all of those sides of the perspective. You know, we know what Reverend Clark said about the battle. We know what Hancock and Adams said about the battle and about the Revolutionary War. What did Margaret, you know, an enslaved woman in Lexington who sued for her freedom towards the end of the war, what did that feel like for her, you know, to hear a lot of that language in the Declaration and in some of the early justifications for the start of the war? And I think it's an important thing to look at that. We're really happy that we have this project that's been funded. We're looking at the lives of two enslaved people who lived at the Hancock Clark House. Their names were Jack and Dinah. And we've told the stories for a long time. The historic site has been around since 1886. We've been telling doing a good job, I think, of telling the stories of John Hancock and Samuel Adams and a lot of the big names that we know of. But the whole story is not just that part of it. It's not just one of those narratives. And so I think we owe it to our community to really look at what did Lexington look like in 1775. Who were the Black men who were on the green that morning? You know, what did the community look like besides just the, you know, the men that we know of who were on the green that morning? And really kind of doing our due diligence and trying to do a better service to history by telling those stories of women and Black people and Native people who were involved in this effort as much, if not more, sometimes as the names we know.
Thank you, Stacy. Tom, how about at the Concord Museum?
Oh, well, again, I invite all the listeners to come visit. And in our opening gallery, there are two really extraordinary artifacts. The first, a young 23-year-old Abner Hosmer, who heard the call go out from Revere and other riders. He was from Acton and woke up that morning, I'm sure not realizing it would be the last morning he would be on this earth. He was at the lead about to cross the bridge, and one of the two soldiers, the local militia, who died. But next to, and we on display, we have his powder horn, and it's just a very moving thing to be adjacent to this artifact that brings to life this one of the first people to give his life for these liberties. But adjacent to it, and as Stacy was saying, we too are doing our due diligence. So. You know, Concord at that time had a population of about 1,500 people, and there were at least 24 enslaved men, women, and children. Massachusetts doesn't abolish slavery until 1783. And we have a looking glass or a mirror that belonged to Casey Whitney. He was enslaved and by a gentleman named Samuel Whitney, who fought at the North Bridge. And so we are quite sure that Case Whitney was by his side. So in this looking glass or mirror, when Case Whitney was a young man, he would have seen the reflection of an enslaved person. But after fighting in the Revolution and for the Revolutionary Army, his enslaver, Samuel Whitney, emancipated him, gave him his freedom. He lived, he was 43 at the time, and he lived another 30 or 40 years. And when he looked in that mirror, he would have seen a free man. So just that one artifact gives you that arc of that one individual's life, extraordinary person whose story was often untold. And now, like the Lexington Historical Society, we're doing our best to be sure those unheard voices are speaking to us through time.
In a little bit of a lightning round, one thing, if listeners are piqued today to do more based on this history, one thing you might recommend that they check out. Stacy.
Just hoping it'll go second. so it's a tricky day because, you know, we're already at 3:38. This is around the time when the parades and things would be winding down and people would be starting to go home. But, you know, we do have, if people don't feel comfortable going out, we have video guided tours, and we have virtual 3D tours on our website of all of our historic houses that would normally be open. All three are witness houses to what happened that morning. And the 3D guided tours really let you look through the houses on your own pace and kind of see all those spaces. And then tomorrow, the weather looks beautiful. We have one of our few in-person events. We have a socially distanced scavenger hunt throughout Lexington. You meet at the Depot building, you get, you know, your piece of paper and your pencils, and you go around with your family and you look for sites throughout town. And there's a prize if you win.
And Tom, lightning round to you. One thing people could do.
Sure. Well, again, I don't want to be too parochial, but I invite people to come. We have a new $1.2 million exhibit that tells the story of April 19th. During COVID, we realized not everyone could come, so we've converted it to a microsite, and it's shotheardroundworld.com. So .org. Take out the buzz, so it's not buzz shot heard round the world, but shotheardroundworld.org. You can find it on our website.
And we will actually post both of your organization's websites on ours at radioboston.org. That's Stacy Fraser, Collections and Outreach Manager for the Lexington Historical Society, and Tom Putnam, Executive Director of the Concord Museum. Stacy and Tom, thanks for educating us about Patriots Day.
Thank
you. Sure, it was fun.
Yep, happy
Great
Patriots
to have you
Day.
Both. To thine own self be true, and it must follow, as the night, the day, thou canst not then be false to any man. Of course, that's a refrain from William Shakespeare's Hamlet, sage advice from Polonius to his son Laertes. And according to a bold, controversial claim, Shakespeare the writer may not have been entirely true to his own self. Here's the theory. William Shakespeare's greatest masterpieces, while written by his hand, were inspired by the life, writings, and plays of someone else, Thomas North. It's the claim made by Dennis McCarthy, a self-taught researcher from the Granite State, who spent more than 15 years digging into this idea. And it's the story told in a new book by Boston journalist Michael Blanding, North by Shakespeare, a rogue scholar's quest for the truth behind the bard's work. And joining us now is author and investigative journalist Michael Blanding. Michael, welcome.
Hello. Thank you for having me on.
It's great to have you. And we have Dennis McCarthy, the rogue scholar that Blanding writes about. Dennis, good to have you as well.
Oh, thank you for having me on.
So, Michael, I'm going to start with you, and we will dig deeply into the theories here in a second. But I want to start. Why'd you write a book about Dennis at his dining room table in New Hampshire looking to alter what we know about Shakespeare? What intrigued you?
Well, I first met Dennis about 6 years ago. He approached me after a book reading that I gave and started telling me these theories. And in the beginning, I really didn't know what to make of them. I found them very far-fetched. And you know, this idea that Shakespeare was plagiarizing or taking these other works somehow and making them into his own, I just didn't find much truth to it. But as he started sending me information and as I started looking more deeply into it, it just started making a lot of sense that, you know, Shakespeare, there's been all kinds of questions about how Shakespeare could have written about legal situations and written about war and written about travels in Italy. And here's this other writer, Thomas North, who had all these experiences and had this, you know, amazingly colorful life. And Dennis was uncovering all of this evidence that he may have written plays himself that Shakespeare then took and adapted and could have done, you know, completely legally and completely at the time, you know, it was very common practice to to take source plays and adapt them and make them your own. And so as I started looking into it, as we started traveling together and exploring these theories, I just felt like it was something that needed to be heard and something that really needed to be considered by scholars.
All right, so let's give Dennis a bit of a drum roll before I turn to you, Dennis, for your first question. And let's do that, Michael, by having you read a little bit from the book early on where you describe that time when Dennis approached you.
Sure. So yeah, just to set the stage, I had given this book reading and Dennis had invited me out for drinks afterwards. And we went to this college bar where there was sort of a very loud kind of impromptu karaoke from other patrons of the bar. But Dennis turned to me and said, "You know how Shakespeare used other sources to write his plays?" McCarthy asked over the din of amateur Bon Jovi. "Sure," I replied, trying to remember anything about Shakespeare's sources from my first year college class. "Well, I found a source no one ever knew about before," he said. "This unknown manuscript," he continued, "was a treatise by 16th century courtier named George North. The work," he claimed, "influenced some of Shakespeare's greatest plays, including Richard III, Macbeth, and King Lear." "But Shakespeare never even read the manuscript," McCarthy continued. "Instead, George's relative, Sir Thomas North, had used it to write his own plays. And Shakespeare had used these earlier plays by Thomas North for his ideas, his language, and even some of his most famous soliloquies." I didn't believe any of it. "Where are Norse plays now?" I asked. "Lost," McCarthy said, "but so were most manuscripts written in the Elizabethan era. Why hadn't anyone discovered this before?" "Because no one had the right tools to do so," he said, arguing excitedly that his computer-assisted techniques had the potential to finally solve the mystery of how and why Shakespeare's plays were written. I vaguely knew about conspiracy theories that Shakespeare was a fraud and the plays were really written by the Earl of Oxford or someone else, but this was something different. McCarthy's theory was more akin to saying Shakespeare plagiarized or collaborated with another writer. The theory seemed outlandish, but I liked McCarthy and was somewhat amused by the lengths to which he'd gone to pitch me. I promised to look at whatever he sent me.
That's author Michael Blanding reading from his new book, North by Shakespeare, A Rogue Scholar's Quest for the Truth Behind the Bard's Work. So, Dennis, we've drumrolled you in here. I'm going to bring you back in, and I'm going to say two things. One, I took from the book that you mean it. You really, really believe that this is the history. And I wanted to go with you. I really did. But there are some pieces missing, and those pieces that are missing don't bother you, right?
Well, what pieces are you talking about? Maybe I can change your mind right here.
Well, let's do that. So you argue, as we just heard, that Thomas North wrote plays that are now lost, but Shakespeare had access to those plays and adapted them. So let's just start with the fact that how did you become so convinced that this piece, these missing plays, were sort of like the missing link in the history of Shakespeare, of explaining Shakespeare?
Sure. Well, there's no doubt that the plays existed. Actually, Shakespeare scholars all agree that there was an earlier Hamlet. In fact, that's how I first discovered Thomas North. I was looking for the author of the earlier Hamlet, which was referred to in 1589, long before Shakespeare could have written his first masterpiece. There's all sorts of fossil evidence, or what I call fossil evidence, or allusions to other early plays. So scholars have known that there was an early Romeo and Juliet, an early Merchant of Venice, an early Timon of Athens. They just didn't know who wrote them. All I'm doing is identifying the author. And I'm doing it with not just a lot of evidence, I'm doing it with it what I believe are to be a lot of smoking guns.
So pick a couple of smoking guns, Dennis, to illustrate for our listeners how you connect these dots.
Sure. We found Thomas North's journal through my partner in crime, June Schluter, who's at Lafayette College. She was editor of the Shakespeare Bulletin and a well-known Shakespeare scholar. And we found Thomas North's actual handwritten unpublished journal. And a number of the passages in there were actually used for Henry VIII. The journal also helps explain Winter's Tale for the first time. And even if you argue that, well, William Shakespeare got a hold of Thomas North's journal, you have the problem that not only did Thomas North, what I believe is, use the entries that he had written in the journal in for some of the passages in Henry VIII, he also used some of the historical works that he used to write the journal. So Thomas North was using these historical passages from Hall's Chronicle and Cavendish's Life of Wolsey to write to write his journal. And those are the same passages, and this is conventional, those same passages that he used to write his journal, he used to write Henry VIII. So you've got a double coincidence there. You've got to have Shakespeare not only has to have access to Thomas North's journal, he has to somehow know what passages that North used in order to write the journal, what these historical passages were from Hall's Chronicle and Cavendish's Life of Wolsey. And that's just impossible. The easiest explanation is that the guy who wrote the source play for this is the guy is Thomas North. And that's why his passages are all throughout Henry VIII and a number of other plays. That's one example.
Okay. Okay, that's a very helpful example. So now there are a couple of things I want to comb out here, and I'm going to start with you, Michael. So part of the core argument here, you talked about it a little bit, Michael, Dennis just talked about it, is there was a person, Thomas North, whose life tracked all the experiences and exposure one would have to be able to write all the plays that Shakespeare wrote. And I'm going to say wrote, even though I know that in the context of this book and many scholars, the argument would be is credited with writing. I just don't have game. I can't hang with that. So I'm just going to use the words I was taught in English myself, right? So, but what you do then, Michael, is you go with Dennis on this journey to retrace some of Thomas North's steps. And that really got you. Tell us just a little bit about that.
Yeah, that was really fascinating. So when I started writing this book, I felt like it would be a really boring book just to have two guys sitting across the table from each other, you know, talking about Shakespeare and Thomas North. So I convinced Dennis to go travel with me to England and Italy and France and visit some of these places and actually, you know, sort of walk in the footsteps of Thomas North and see how it might have influenced these plays. And so we went to an Italian palace that may have influenced The Winter's Tale, in which there are these amazing frescoes on the wall that were made by this Italian artist that Shakespeare mentions in the plays, and no one knows how or why he mentioned that artist in particular. We went to an English castle that may have figured into A Midsummer Night's Dream, where there was just this amazing festival that Midsummer Night's Dream, many scholars believe, was actually based on that festival. And that was created by this lord by the name of Robert Dudley, the Earl of Leicester, who is this sort of longtime suitor of Queen Elizabeth and happened to be Thomas North's patron. And in fact, Dennis uncovered many clues in many of the plays that seem to relate to this quest by Leicester to marry the queen, and not only references referring to his own desire to marry the queen, but also other references sort of mocking or trashing other suitors that were also in the running, that, you know, at the time Shakespeare wrote his plays, many of them were dead, or many of them, you know, were no longer, you know, a part of that story. And so it was really fascinating to me to sort of go to these places and see these stories from Thomas North's own life, as well as the life of his patron, the Earl of Leicester, and find these clues in the plays that might have suggested why he wrote particular scenes or particular passages in the ways that he did.
And it is fascinating. I learned a ton about Elizabethan history, and I will say the part that was most compelling to me in this argument was the wide experiences that Thomas North had that then show up in Shakespeare's plays. Dennis, I want to turn back to you, because one of the other things that's fascinating about this story in Michael's book is you. I mean, you are a character in this story. You broke into another scholarly area in geobiology without a PhD in that field, wound up a hugely respected thinker, decided to take some of the techniques from there, and what the heck, try them on Shakespeare, which, A, wow, and then became widely controversial. I mean, scholars in Shakespeare hate your ideas here. So talk a little bit about all of that, about being you trying to do this.
Yes, right. Not all scholars. Some scholars have been very kind to me. A lot of the top scholars, Stephen Greenblatt and of course June Schluter, who's my partner,
right,
have been extremely respectful. Michael Dobson's another one. And it's really, there's just people who are very emotional. Some scholars are very emotionally involved in their particular idea of Shakespeare. And so they are It's like what I'm claiming is sacrilegious, and I'm a blasphemer, and there's, you know,
it's heresy.
They just hate me through and through. So there's no way to get on their good side. And but they're really, they themselves don't even have a candidate for the early author of these early plays. They're just hoping to God it's not Thomas North, even though all his passages are in the plays.
So what does it tell us about Shakespeare? Is it a condemnation of Shakespeare, Dennis, if you're right?
I don't really think it is, simply because other people and other playwrights at the time were also adapting works. And that's the word I would use, adaptation. That's what Shakespeare was doing. And we have records from the era of others, of all the other top playwrights, often rewriting other plays. The only difference is that Shakespeare started getting credit for the older plays. And he didn't just get credit also for Thomas North's plays. He also got credit for even for like Yorkshire Tragedy, which was a Thomas Middleton play, and that was published with his name on it. And so he started getting credit for all the plays his company was producing, simply because he was the most successful play producer at the time. And they were putting his own close adaptations of Norse work, and he would have a few plays published at the time under his name. He started out by saying that they were corrected and augmented. That's what the title pages said. And then after he died, when they put the first folio out with all the plays, that's when he really became known as the original and sole author of the mm-hmm. masterpieces. But at the time he was writing, people knew that he was adapting works. And I don't think he was trying to disguise that fact.
All right, we are almost out of time. So Michael, I'm going to turn back to you. In a sentence or two, what is the lesson you want people to take from this book?
Well, I think that, you know, people ask, what does it matter who wrote the plays? They're still the same plays, right? They're still these works of genius, you know, that we've read for literally hundreds of years. But I think that for me, considering these theories and looking at them through Dennis's eyes and through Thomas North's eyes, really do explain a lot of elements about the plays and make them potentially so much richer. And, you know, when you consider, for example, that Thomas North was writing these translations that were all about, you know, what makes a good ruler. And then you look at, you know, so many of the questions in the plays, not just the English histories, but Hamlet, Macbeth, King Lear, you know, even As You Like It, The Tempest, they're all about that same question. And, you know, if you look at elements of Thomas North's life and consider that maybe he wrote a play about Henry V while he was at war, wrote King
Michael,
Lear while
I'm
he was
so
suffering
sorry.
Poverty.
Michael, we got to go. Really, I'm so sorry.
I'm sorry. No, it just makes them so much more richer. And I think for that reason, it's really worth exploring.
All right, Michael Blandon and Dennis McCarthy of North by Shakespeare, A Rogue Scholar's Quest for the Truth Behind the Bard's Work. Thank you.